You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
It's extraordinary video as complete strangers band together into a human chain to come to the rescue of a family caught in a riptide.
The water, when it starts going around, there's nothing that can save you.
80 beachgoers rushed into the water and joined hands when they heard the cries for help. It happened on a beautiful beach day in Panama City, Florida, on the Gulf Coast.
A young mother of four was enjoying a day at the beach when she saw two of her boys out in the water screaming for help. They were caught in a deadly riptide. Mom bravely swam to their rescue, but she got caught in the riptide as well. So did the boy's grandmother. Others tried to help. Altogether, 9 people were in danger of drowning.
The chain started in very shallow water close to shore. It went on for 300 feet in water about 15 feet deep. Jessica Simmons was having dinner on the beach when she heard the cries.
I was like, I can help these people. I grabbed a man's hand, another man, I don't even know who they were, and I grabbed their hands and just pulled to pull the last girl in.
You can see someone exhausted being carried out of the water. Bystanders on the beach erupted in cheers when the last person was rescued. Once safely on shore, she collapsed on the beach. Among those rescued was 8-year-old Stephen Ursi and his mom, Roberta.
We got caught in the current and, well, our mom had to go in after me and my brother, and the people made a human chain and pulled us out.
As a mama, I'm supposed to be able to protect them and do everything, and I couldn't do it that day. I had to have help.
The boy's grandmother suffered a heart attack during the ordeal and is still in the intensive care unit. The whole family is forever thankful to all those strangers who formed a human chain that saved their lives.
Had we not done what we did, they would have drowned.
So 80 strangers banding together to make a human chain to rescue 9 people out of a riptide, rip current. And if you saw in that video as you watched, and I maybe could have said this ahead of time, but did you notice that those people were different sizes? Those people were different genders. Those people were different races. Those people were different ages. And I'd be willing to bet that those people had different jobs. And those people, you know, weren't all professional beach chain rescuers. As a matter of fact, the reason they did that is because that particular day, there were no lifeguards on duty. So there were no, there were no lifeguards there. So the people had to join together, and they were diverse, unique. They probably did not show up at the beach that day and say, you know what, today, let's form a human chain. That's what I'm going to do on my day today. Okay, first get there, put the stuff out into the sand, you know, get your blanket out, yell at the kids because as soon as you open the blanket, they get all the sand on the blanket, shake the blanket out, put the blanket back down, then the kids come on and the wind blows, you give up with the sand on the blanket. Okay, then a few minutes after that, we'll get out the book, we'll start to read, and how about 10 minutes later, then we go and form a human chain and rescue some people out of the water. It probably was not part of their agenda that day, but these people joined together of all sorts of backgrounds, colors, genders, ages, to come together for the sake of saving 9 people. And as you saw, those 9 people were pretty grateful that people came together. And so we are on part 2 of this 4-week series where we look at, called The Wall, where we're looking at Nehemiah as he has come together, as he is going to Jerusalem to rebuild the city wall. And just to get you up to speed, if you were not here last week, by the way, you can listen to last week's point at mc3church.org. Click on Listen to the Point and look for the wall logo or the wall symbol. But last week, the way the story starts is the people of Israel had been exiled. They had been sent out of their land by a foreign country, the Babylonians. And the Babylonians, they lost their control of power and the Persians took over. And in the process of this time, they were out in exile for 70 years. And some people were allowed to go back through Ezra, led a group of people back to the land. And a guy named Zerubbabel led some people back to the land. And so they were allowed to return to their land after 70 years because the new Persian king was letting people go back. And actually, as part of their strategy for domination, they made everybody happy. So as long as everybody's happy, then they're going to submit to us as the authority. And so Nehemiah gets this word from a friend of his who was over in the land of Jerusalem, of Israel, and says, you know, how are things going? Oh, it's terrible. The walls are destroyed and we're just not safe. It's a dangerous place, a dangerous way to be living because the walls were security and safety for everything. And so Nehemiah is heartbroken, and instead of going and trying to fix it and solve it and complain about it, he prays. And God, in a miraculous, incredible way, and we talked more about that last week, so I'm not going to get into it today. God allowed the king to send Nehemiah, and not just send him to this land to rebuild the walls, but basically give him everything that he needed to do it. And so we finished last week in chapter 2 of Nehemiah looking at the idea that Nehemiah is now in the land. He's inspected the walls and he shares with the leaders of the people that are living there and says, look, here's what God has sent me to do, to rebuild this wall. And they're like, yes, let's do it. And so that picks us up here in chapter 3 of Nehemiah, where Nehemiah is about to build the wall. And what you're going to see here is Nehemiah is bringing together people of all sorts of backgrounds to build this wall and to make this wall. And again, we're talking about a security wall around the city, because at that time, anybody could come in and steal and rob. You know, you had all sorts of crazy things. We talked about mad cows, you know, just wild cows, which are dangerous. And things like that, I'm sure, that lived in the land. And so this was a big deal. Like, it's for us, like I said last week, it'd be sort of like you having a house, you're returning to your house, but you have no windows or doors. And so you're not really feeling very safe and secure. So that's where we pick up the story today. And it's this idea of all these people coming together for one big purpose. And the point that I want you to get this week is when you're facing the wall, put aside your pride and share the work. And we're going to see that here because it's easy for us to be like, nah. It was easy for the people of Nehemiah's time, like, no, it's not my job. It's not my thing. It's not my deal. Sorry. And in that video, in that story of that rescue, people could have been like, you know what? I am not a professional lifeguard. You know, I spent some time in the circus, but I'm not a human chain. I'm the ones that stand on other people's shoulders. So sorry, if we had to stand on shoulders, I could have done it, but I'm not a human chain person. No, they didn't do that. They said, you know what, it's not about me. It's about saving these people. It's about the bigger goal. It's about the bigger task that is in front of us. And so they put aside their pride and shared the work. And that's something that we're going to talk about for us. When does our pride get in the way of doing what God has called us to do? When are we making excuses? And we'll come to that in a little bit. But when you're facing the wall, put aside your pride and share the work. Now, I spent some time chewing on how in the world, actually a long time, chewing on how in the world am I going to teach this passage, because I want to be true to the Word of God. But let's be honest, Nehemiah 3 is not the most compelling reading in the world. You know, it's as we'll see here, we're going to pull some things apart. So instead of me reading 32 verses of, and this person built this part of the wall, and next to him, this person, son of this person, built the wall, and next to him, this person, son of this person, built the wall, and next to him, so it's kind of boring. We're going to pull some pieces out of that because there's some really cool stuff in here. But what I'm going to do in the very first verse of chapter 3, and actually we'll hit the house lights here. If you have a paper Bible, we're in Nehemiah chapter 3. If you have the free YouVersion app, which if you don't have it, I encourage you to download it for free. It's available on every device. We're on Nehemiah, which is in the Old Testament, so that's about halfway in to the scrolling list, and we're going to tap on chapter 3, and that's where we're starting on verse 1. And verse 1 says this, and it just gets more interesting from there. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. So what we're going to do here is I want to, instead of walking you through the text, instead of talking through the actual words, what's the word for words? The word words. Instead of the actual literature, I'm still looking for that word. It'll come to me. But anyway, instead of that, I want to talk to you through this geographically. And I think that might be a little bit more interesting. And if you want to go home and read this on your own, you certainly may. And the Word of God, all of it is inspired and is useful. And we'll see some things that are here. I'm just saying, 32 verses of talking about who was next after this person. We don't have that much time. We're already missing an hour of sleep. So this is what we're going to do. So here's a map. And this map here, I don't know if you can kind of see what's going on here, but this is a map and generally the idea of what the walls would have looked like in Nehemiah's time. And I'm getting really fancy here. Laser pointer. Where's a cat when you need one? What we're going to be doing is that this shape here is the walls that ended up getting rebuilt. And as you look at this, there's some question marks. I don't know if you can see that there. They're not exactly sure where some of these areas were, but they are sure about some of the other areas. And so this is kind of the general, as they've excavated and all sorts of historical records and everything, about what the wall looks like. And Nehemiah chapter 3, Nehemiah actually walks us through geographically and counterclockwise around the walls. And so I'm going to read just some select verses here just to give you an idea of what was going on and the scope of this project and how huge it was and then how incredible it was that it was completed. So we're going to start right here. That's the sheep gate. That's cool. Don't go any further yet. That's the sheep gate, and that's where it starts this story in, as we just read there in verse 1. And Billy's going to follow along with me, and you can kind of watch. Again, we're going to go in a counterclockwise motion, so we're going to be going around here, and I'll just share some of these verses, and again, you can kind of follow along and jump with me if you want, or just listen and watch up here. And by the way, some of these other things here, this is what the wall today looks like, because the city is much bigger these days, and this is the broad wall, because it is. I'm not sure, but apparently that's important. So if you're wondering, that's where it is. If you're like, you woke up this morning, you're like, oh, man, I feel so refreshed. I wonder where the broad wall is. Well, now you know. Right there. Okay? So we'll see some other things here that are kind of cool, too. So starting in verse 1, we've already got this right there. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Verse 3, the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasanah. Verse 6, the Jeshana gate was repaired by Joadiah, son of Pasiah, and Meshulam, son of Besodiah. Something like that. Verse 13, jumping down a little bit more. The valley gate was repaired by Hanum and the residents of Zanoah. And I should stop right there and let you know, in between these verses, it's explaining how the person next to them built, and then the person next to them, what they did. So Nehemiah here in this chapter is literally covering every square foot of this wall, starting at the sheep gate. So I'm just kind of giving you the main categories, but it's explaining that, you know, here between the sheep gate and the fish gate, all of that space had someone building here, and then next to that there was a person building here, and next to that there was a person building here. So going on, where am I? I said Valley Gate. Okay, number four, verse 14. The Dung Gate was repaired by Malchijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth Harakim. And just so you know, the reason the Dung Gate was called the Dung Gate, we talked about it last week. It says dung in the Bible. It's because that's where they went to go to the dump. Like, that was the, not... The dump was outside of the Dung Gate. And so that's why they called it that, because that's where they took the trash to the dump. Okay, you got me. All right, moving on here. Verse 15, the Fountain Gate was repaired by Shalom, son of Kol-Hezor, ruler of the district of Mizpah. So where are we there? Yeah, the Fountain Gate down at the bottom there. Next to him, verse 25, sorry, next to him, Pedaiah, son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on the hill of Ophel made repairs up to a point opposite the water gate. Nixon was not there. Verse 28, above the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. And this is important, because one of the things we hear multiple times through this chapter is that people were building the area in front of their house. That's going to matter in a moment. Where am I? Verse 29, next to him, Shemaiah, son of Shechaniah, and the guard at the east gate made repairs. Verse 31, next to him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants opposite the inspection gate and as far as the room above the corner. You know, the room above the corner. And then verse 32, and between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and merchants made repairs. So there we go. We've just looped around the whole thing. Interesting point of reference here, the Pool of Siloam. If you were here a couple weeks ago, you may remember that name because there was this guy who doesn't know much, but he knew this. I once was blind, but now I see. And that was the same place where Jesus, this guy was blind, and he put the mud on his eyes and said, go wash in the Pool of Siloam. So this is the same place, just so you're aware of that. You know, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. I once was blind, but now I see. If you weren't here for that, you can listen to it at mc3church.org and look for next, the series that we covered then. So that is kind of a quick overview of chapter 3 of how this wall was built. And again, it says person was here, and right next to them was this person. And right next to them was this person. And they were all together building this wall, many of them in front of where they lived. And so it was pretty incredible. But here's the crazy part about it. And we are going to look at, we'll see this again later, but just a little spoiler. Coming up in chapter 6, this is what chapter 6, verse 15 says. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul. And you're like, cool. But here's the cool part. In 52 days. So in 52 days, this wall that was destroyed, that was in shambles. And if you remember last week, there were some spots where Nehemiah couldn't even get through because it was so messed up. And we're not talking about like a fence. We're not talking about like a hedgerow. We're talking about a wall, a serious wall of fortification that a bunch of nobodies came together and built. That's pretty impressive in 52 days. And understand that these nobodies weren't, they weren't contractors. They weren't brick masons or stone masons. They were just everyday people that lived there. And all pitched in to share the work. So we talked last week about how Nehemiah is studied outside of church world, studied as a great leader and a great example of leadership. And so I just want to look for a moment about what this guy did. Now, granted, God was working through him. He shared at the end of last week about how this is what God has put on his heart. And everybody's like, hey, if God is for us, let's do this thing. Let's do it. And so I want to talk about how everybody was coming together. And just to highlight a few of the things that are going on, because right now we're like, wow, that was really exciting. Hey, maybe next week we can read a genealogy. But if you were here a couple years ago for Christmas, we can make genealogies exciting too. But here we've got this idea of all these people building, but I want to draw out a few things that are incredible, that are hidden in here, that we might kind of miss if we read too quickly. And so you had all these people working together regardless. Then we're going to look at four different things that was regardless of. So despite their background, they worked together regardless. There we go. They worked together, and that's what's so cool about this. These are all these people, like you look at these people on the beach coming together to rescue this person, these nine people actually. And here you have all these people coming together regardless of some different things about them. And again, not contractors, not stonemasons, not, this wasn't their job. This wasn't who they were. But they came together for this project because they put their pride aside. So the first thing is that they work together regardless of their position and their position. And what I'm talking about here is that there were people that were in positions of authority. They were in positions of leadership. They were in positions of both political and spiritual leadership. And we're going to see here in just a moment, there were three groups of people that are found throughout some of these verses. First was priests. And actually in verse 1 there were priests, then there were rulers, and then in verse 17 there were the Levites. So we'll talk about it through the verse. Thank you, Billy. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. That's what we read the very first verse there. So here you've got a guy who is the high priest. The high priest was in charge of the temple worship. And if you remember from last week, and remember even from the Word 3 series, the temple had already been rebuilt by Ezra, who came before Nehemiah a few years, depending on your timing there, to rebuild the temple. And so you have a high priest. They're the most important person leading the temple worship. They are the key main person. And then even the priests, the rest of the priests served in the temple. It was a big deal. This was like the governors and the president all kind of coming together and building and putting in a hand to build. Because the high priest, like, he did not have to do that. He could have said on so many levels, sorry, that's not me. I'm too important. I'm the high priest here. And everybody would have been like, you're right. Your job is to make sure our worship with God is true and correct and all of that. But the high priest and his fellow priests got involved. And then multiple times throughout this, I just picked one of them. You see here in verse 9, Rephaiah, son of Hur, which would be Ben-Hur, is how you would say that in Hebrew, Ben-Hur. Anyway, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. So now you have a political leader. He is a ruler of a district. He could have been like, you know what? I'm the boss, and you build the wall. Go ahead and do it, because that's what you do, and this is what I do. And you see multiple different leaders and rulers throughout this passage that stepped in and built. And then there at the very, halfway through the passage, in verse 17, it says next to him, talking about the guy that was building there, the repairs were made by the Levites under Rehum, son of Bani. And so here you've got Levites, and the Levites were the special tribe. I don't have time to get into all of that, but they were sort of the unique tribe of Israel. They were the unique division of Israel that that had some special privilege, some special responsibility, special authority. They were the ones in charge of the overall, the tabernacle, and we talked about that during the Dwell series years ago. They were the ones that were in charge of that. So they were elevated in their position. They were important. They weren't just a common, everyday person. They were the Levites. They were a set-apart, special, unique group of people who could have, all three of these groups, could have said, I'm too important. You do that, and I'll do what I do. But we see that those people jumped in. These people got involved and picked up rocks and stones and built the wall, despite their position. Despite that they had every right. And honestly, if those people, any one of those people, because of the culture there, if they said, no, please, you do that, and we'll focus on worshiping God, everybody would be like, cool, yeah, that is totally your right. But they put aside their pride and shared the work. So that's the first group of people. They worked together despite their position. The second group of people here we see as we look through this passage is people that work together regardless of their profession. So you had people, and again, there probably were people in this process somewhere that were actually like, yep, this is what I do. I build walls. I'm the wall guy, and I do that. But many people, most of the people, that was not their job. And so they had different jobs. And as you look through the passage, you see people with completely different jobs. And some of these people are like, maybe they shouldn't be building a wall. Like, as we look at that, like, you know what you're doing there? But again, Nehemiah and God were kind of leading some things here. But we see four different groups of people here, and then we'll go to the passage in just a second. We see a goldsmith, a perfume maker, possibly bakers, and then merchants. And so look at these four different passages here that are kind of scattered through. And you see this more than just in these passages. But in verse 8, there's two things we see. First of all, it says, Uzziah, son of Harahiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section. So here's a guy that makes gold, does jewelry, does, you know, fancy goldery workage. And that is a precision art. Let's just be straight about that. Like, this isn't something where you're like, here, gold. Like, no, they have to refine the gold, and maybe they smelt it or melt it. And then smelt it, and then hammer it, and bend it, and shape it, and make gold things. That's what goldsmiths do. They're not wall builders. But a goldsmith jumped in. And then Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, make repairs next to that. So you've got a guy that his job is to make perfumes. This person is to make things that smell good. He was like Old Spice of the Old Testament. The job was to make things smell good. And, I mean, honestly, right? Let's think about this for a second. You're in Israel. It's like a desert. People are building a wall in 52 days. I think people would be like, dude, perfume maker? Get going on the perfume because it stank around here. These people are stanky and gross. But no, here's a perfume maker pitching in to build the wall. That is not his profession. That is not his job. He is a perfume maker, and he is getting involved. And a little bit later in verse 11, we see that Malchijah, son of Harim, and Hashub, son of Pathua Moab, repaired, and totally quote me on all these names because I am spot on. Just hashtag Sean knows the words right, or something like that. Anyway, so Pahath Moab repaired another section, and the Tower of Ovens. And here's why I was talking about. There's definitely an area where in the city, and actually it's on the map there, but we won't jump back there because the computer crashed once on us already today. But there was this place called the Tower of Ovens. And what this area was a place literally where there were ovens for baking. And in that area of the city, that's where the bakers worked. That's where the people that baked and cooked and did the baking. Like, you would go to that district to get your bread for the day. And so the reason why I have bakers as a question mark is because we saw that people are building near their homes and near where they live and where they would live where they worked. And so it's a very good chance that these people rebuilding the Tower of Ovens area are bakers. They are people that work with bread and dough and yeast and not stone and rock and mortar or whatever they built walls out of back then. But they chipped in. So if you don't want to hold that one, we can. We're not really sure, but it's possible you have bakers involved. And then on verse 32, near the very end, it says, in the between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths, we already saw them, these are other goldsmiths, and merchants made repairs. So merchants, these are people involved in trade. They're the ones that do the marketplace. They're the money changers, the money lenders. And there's so much, by the way, that we could talk about with just this passage about all the things that kind of evolved from the end of the book of Nehemiah, which is basically when the Old Testament ends historically, chronologically, and how it all kind of got all messed up by the time Jesus showed up on the scene. Because at that point, the merchants were corrupt. So you had merchants. These people were like the bankers. They were the people that were involved in trade. And here they are wearing their three-piece suits and their gold watches made by the goldsmith. And they're out there building a wall. Their fingers were getting dirty. They put their calculators in their back pocket and they got to it. Probably. That's speculation that they had calculators. You can Google it. I'm sure you can find out the answer if in the Old Testament they were using calculators. But the point is, you had all these different people that despite their job, despite their profession, their occupation, they got involved and built the wall. So then you've got the people, despite their position, regardless of their profession. And then the third category here was regardless of their possession. Bear with me here, and I'm not even going to look over in that corner because I know that there's someone back there that hates it when I do these these word things. But these people in this category here, that this wasn't their city. This wasn't their city. They're here putting in this work and working hard, and they were outsiders. This wasn't their possession. This wasn't their thing. And yet here we find them serving. And so you've got Jerichoans and Gibeonites and Mizpahianiteers, I guess is what you call someone who's from Mizpah. You can figure that one out. And then we see Tekoans as well. And so here, looking at the different verses here in that passage, chapter 3, it says, the men of Jericho built the adjoining section in verse 2. And Zachor, son of Imri, built the next to them. So you've got people from Jericho. Jericho is a different city. This isn't their city. Their city had walls before, and if you remember, they kind of fell down when everybody walked around them. So they know a thing or two about walls. Now, it's a whole generations later, just to be clear. But so they're over here from Jericho in Jerusalem, rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. This wasn't their thing, but they were helping out. Next to them, in verse 7, repairs were made by men from Gibeon and Mizpah. Malatia of Gibeon and Jadon of Meronoth, placed under the authority of the governor of the Trans-Euphrates. So you had people from Gibeon and Mizpah, again, other areas that were here in the city of Jerusalem rebuilding the wall that wasn't their wall. And then later in verse 27, we see next to them the men of Tekoa repaired another section from the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel. And so again, a third group of people, or fourth, I guess, if you count Gibeon and Mizpahianiteers as separate, but men of Tekoa, Tekoans, that were all here building, and this wasn't even their wall. And yet, They put aside their pride. They could have been like, sorry, that's not my city. You know what? If you come to Jericho and want to rebuild this wall, history isn't so good, but I'll work with you. But they said no. They put aside their pride and they stepped in and built the wall. And then we've got a fourth group of people. People regardless of their position, their profession, their possession, and finally their place in life. And here we're talking about a group of people that are young and women together, which to the point, they're called the Daughters of Shalom, Daughters of Shalom, to the point where actually some scholars, when they saw this in verse 12, why don't we just go to verse 12 right there, I'll read it to you. It says, Shalom, son of Halosha-Hashash, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. And the word here implies young daughters, not like five-year-olds, but they're not like, you know, these aren't middle-aged women. These are younger girls, teenagers, whatever. And this was so unusual that some scholars feel like there must have been some sort of a mistake, that something was wrong. But they've gone back and studied the original text, the original language, and there's nothing that says that this was an accident. So here you've got, again, and this is God all the time. Like, God's all about, you know what? I'm going to break down the walls, not these walls, but I'm going to break down the walls that you have in your mind about what is right and what's wrong and how this works. Like, and for these people to see a young woman, women, helping with the wall was huge. And so they didn't say, well, sorry, we're women, can't do it. They didn't say, we're too young. When we get older, we'll help. And they could have. And people have been like, yeah, you're right. You're young. You just, it's okay. You guys, you go do your thing. I get it. Like, again, in that culture, that was totally acceptable. But here they were, despite their place in life, getting involved. They put aside their pride and helped to build the wall. So you've got these four different groups of people that makes this passage so interesting because, you know, you can read through and there's more than just some of these examples, especially when you look at the different professions and the different positions of these people. But they all came together regardless of their position. They could have said, no, we're too important. We're too, you know, and not even in an arrogant way, but just in a real way. Like, hey, you do the building and I'll do the pointing. They could have done that. And everybody would be like, that's your job. Cool. Regardless of their profession, like, I make things smell good. You want me lifting blocks and putting them over here and building the wall? That's not my thing. Smell good. That's my thing. And they could have been like, oh, you're right. Please help us smell good. Do your smithery with the gold. Because that's a hammer. That's what I'm doing. I'm hammering. That's what they do. Or maybe it's like this. Or don't nod your head. You don't know. Shake your head at me. Maybe they did. Were you there? Anyway, who do you think you are, young lady? Oh, wait. Okay, despite their possession, you know, there were people that could have said, this isn't our deal, this isn't our wall, this isn't our problem. But they all got involved and you know, worked. And we're going to come next week to even, like, we're going to go to the next level on this because these people, spoiler, aren't just building. They're also defending at the same time. But that's next week. We'll talk about opposition and some of the problems that they faced. But just understand that these people were from all sorts of backgrounds, had every reason, even their place in life, as young women could have said, no, this isn't our thing, and they all got involved. Why? Because they saw the magnitude of the project. They saw what God was doing, saw how incredible it was, and said, you know what, I'm going to put aside my pride and get involved in the work. And that's the point. When you're facing the wall, put aside your pride and share the work. So, that was Nehemiah. That's Nehemiah chapter 3. That means we've got 2 weeks to cover a lot more chapters of Nehemiah. So it might go a little bit faster the next few weeks here. But I want to take this and say, okay, what does this mean? Because one of the things, if you remember, and I'm like all about like advertising our previous series here. Like, we don't get any kind of cut for you listening to them online. But we did a series about a year ago called Cropped. And in this series, we talked about how people take Bible passages and they cut out the parts that they don't like and make it say what they want it to say. And one particular week, we looked at a passage in the Old Testament, and I'm not going to get into that, you can listen to it online, where there was this Old Testament passage, and everybody's like, oh, this is about America. And it's not. And again, you can listen to that. But what we learned that day was this idea that Israel's promises, God made specific promises to Israel, to the Old Testament. And from those promises, there are principles that we can take today. So Israel's promises are our principles. That's what we learned that particular week. And I want to say here, God has not called MC3 or you as followers of Jesus to build a wall. I don't think. He may have. But this isn't like, okay, all of you need to go out and pick up a block and get going. So we can't just directly say this applies to us. But what are some of the principles that we can take from this passage? What are some of the things that we see here? And what we see here is that there is a big God project in front of the people of Israel. And it is to build this wall. It is for safety. It is to rescue, to save the people. And if you were paying attention last month in the next series, we do have a big God-sized project in front of us, and that is to share with this world the hope of Jesus. Because people need Jesus. People don't need to become Christians. People don't need to go to church. Those are all extra. People need Jesus because Jesus can change our lives and certainly change our eternity. And next month, and we're starting Easter Sunday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. It really is April Fool's Day and Easter and somebody's birthday. But we're going to start this series called Burn, and we're going to spend 4 weeks talking about why hell is real and awful and why Jesus matters. And so before us, we have this huge task with God's strength, just like the people of Israel, to say, what can we do? What has God called us to do? God has called us to reach this world, to reach Mifflin County, to reach the people you work with, the people you live next to, the people that you're related to, because they need Jesus. And again, that's what last month was all about and why we have the invite cards, because we want to do that. So my question for you is, as we take this thing we see in the Old Testament, what is the principle that we need to apply? Is what is your pride holding you up from doing? What is your pride keeping you from doing something, unlike these people in Nehemiah's time that were able to put aside these things and get to the task? What is holding you up? What is holding you back? What are the excuses that you are making? And so I want to take these four different groups of people and maybe make that more of an application to us as well. Because we talked about this idea of pride, and pride is arrogance, pride is selfishness. I mean, the root of everything that we call sin, that the Bible calls sin, is selfishness. Anything that is wrong is because we think we're better than that other person, and ultimately we're better than God, we're better than the situation. I mean, it's all about us. Any sin comes back to this idea of pride and selfishness, which is pride is a fancy word for selfishness. But so pride says some things, and I want to look at these and ask you to think. When there's this big task in front of you, and maybe it isn't just a generic, hey, we need to reach the world, which is true, but maybe it's something specific. Maybe God has called you to do something, and you're like, well, and you make some excuses here. So I want to look at these, and then in your prime groups this week, you're going to have a chance to really kind of get real with each other and say, here's my excuse. Here's the one that I make, and to be praying for each other, that you'll be able to say no more excuses. I'm going to put aside my pride and get involved in the work. So pride says a few things. The first thing is that if you're talking about your position, pride says, I'm too important. And it is easy. And I don't care what your position is. It is easy to sit back. And I am not saying it's wrong to lead. I am not saying it's wrong to be in charge, to be in oversight, anything like that. I'm saying, are you using that sometimes as an excuse to not do what God has called you to do? Because that's this issue. That's the issue that says, I'm too important. That's not my, sorry, I'm not down there. And, I've got some things I wrote here. Because you're the boss. sorry, I can't help you with this one. And maybe this is a time where God is saying, you know what? You need to do this. And you're like, too important. Sorry. Maybe as a husband. Oh, I'm the man of the house. I will not change diapers or clean the floor. I'm too important. Don't go there. It's a dangerous place to be. But I know, like, that's a temptation. Maybe you're a parent. And yes, is your job to parent your children and direct them and guide them and lead them? Yes. Is your job to serve them sometimes? Yes, it is. They need to see you serve them so they know how to do it. So don't get stuck back on this. I'm too important to do that. So how do we deal with that? Well, if you think, well, my position is too important. Please shut down right now, because this passage is going to wreck you. It's going to mess up your whole little circle of your greatness in comparison to everything else. Because in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, this is what Paul writes to the church in Philippi. He says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Don't sit around and say, I'm too important. He says, rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Other people, put others first. If God is calling you to do something, sometimes you're going to say, I got to put them first. That's a really good principle, Paul. Thank you. Not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of others. Great. Good stuff, Paul. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that in Philippians to the church in Philippi. And you're right. I'm going to think of others as better than myself when it works out in my situation. Because I am kind of important. Then he goes on and says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus. Ooh, did you have to go there? I'm supposed to be like, but Jesus, this is what Paul says. Who, Jesus, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Jesus is God. There is no godier than Jesus. God, Jesus is God. And he says, you know, you have the same attitude that Jesus had, who is God. And he didn't use his godliness to say, sorry, I'm too important. Instead, he came to this earth and died. I'm getting off of the passage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. So he came to this earth, became a servant, became human, and dealt with all of our awfulness and what is the fancy word called the hypostatic union, that Jesus is fully man and fully God. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So here we have Jesus. You think you're too important. You know who is too important? Jesus. And if Jesus said, you know what? I'm too important to come down and rescue you, we would all be going to hell with no hope. And so I'm really glad that Jesus didn't use his position to say, you know what? I'm too important for you loser people that are always turning your back on you, that are always going the wrong way. And yet he still says, I love you enough. I'm going to humble myself. I'm going to become like you. I'm going to live among you. I'm going to be an example to you. And then I'm going to die for you. So please do not say that you are too important, because your attitude should be the same. Your mindset should be the same as Christ Jesus. So pride says, with our position, I'm too important. Well, maybe pride says, with your profession. And the answer here is, that's not my job. That's not my job. And I'm not talking about, you know, whether you're a banker or an optometrist or a mail carrier, postal worker. Rise up. Golly, all around here. Like, they're growing on us here. It's getting crazy. But I'm not talking about your job. I'm talking about, you know, this idea, especially when you look at our gifts. And this is where, you know, we have been given specific gifts. As followers of Jesus, the Holy Spirit has given us gifts. And again, if I may allude to a series we did a year ago called Gifts, where we looked at what the different gifts are we receive from God as we are. But they are supernatural abilities given by God to serve Him, to grow the body of Christ, to grow the church, to reach people with Jesus. And it's easy sometimes, especially like, for example, last month we're talking about reaching out to people. It's easy to be like, oh, I do not have the gift of evangelism, so that's not my job. I don't have to do that. You know what? That person is really needy, and they need compassion right now, and that's not my gift. sorry, someone else is going to have to deal. And this idea of saying that it's not my job is a problem, because sometimes we need to put aside our pride and get involved in the work. And again, God has given us gifts on purpose, and they are unique, and we all work together in a beautiful way, and we'll get to that in a moment. But don't just sit back and be like, oh, yeah, look at that. It looks like you need some help. Well, I don't have the gift of help, so hopefully you don't die while you're drowning right there. Like, no, you jump in. And this is what Paul writes to the church in Corinth about himself in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. There we go. He says, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. He's like, look, I don't have to do this, but I'm doing this because I want to see as many people as possible come to Jesus. He said, to the Jewish people, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I'm not under the law myself, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. He's saying here, look, I'm talking to someone, and they speak Spanish. And I keep yelling at them and saying, you need Jesus, you need Jesus, you need Jesus. And they're going, no comprendo, por favor, no puede entiendo que se te dijiste. Sorry, I had to translate a little faster than I was ready for. So what do? You speak in Spanish. And you say, I mean, if you knew Spanish, you tell them about their need for the Salvador, de Jesucristo. Why? Because if you're going to reach someone, if you're going to speak to someone that speaks differently, you're going to have to do things that are different, that are outside of who you are sometimes. And if someone's drowning, and you can say, sorry, I am not an arm ring maker, hopefully you can make it. No, you step in and you make a human chain. Because we can't just sit back and say, that's my job. And he goes on to say here, I'm not even done, I'm getting all excited. He says, I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means, I might save some. I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. What's he saying? He's saying, look, sometimes when I put my pride aside and become like someone that I don't have to become, or to act like them, or I don't mean act like them in an appropriate way, but to engage them and to talk to them on their terms, I don't do this for me. I do it for the gospel. And when this happens and God uses me because I decide to step down out of my gift set and help them, I'm able to be a part of them coming to Jesus and turning their life around. He says, that's awesome. And so don't sit back and say, well, that's not my job. That's not my gift. And again, I'm not saying don't use your gifts. I'm not saying that we aren't supposed to work together as the church, because we are. And there are some people that are going to be really good at things and not really good at things. And again, we talked about that at least our prime group, I don't know if all the other ones did, about the idea of our different evangelism, our invite styles, and how we need kind of everybody to do their part. So don't miss that we need to work together and do our part. But don't sit back and be like, no, that's not my job. Because we miss opportunities to reach people for Jesus. And as we said, it was in the next series, I know we talked about how you might be the only person that has a spiritual influence on the life of someone. You might think, oh, there's probably plenty of other people in life, but you might be the only one. So don't sit back and be like, well, that's not my job. Sometimes we need to put aside our pride and get involved that way. So pride says, position, I'm too important. Profession, that's not my job. Possession says, that's not my problem. And this one works so well when it doesn't have to do with us. Because when we see someone with an issue, if they're part of our inner circle, we'll be like, yeah, let's help them with that. But if they're outside of that circle, and I don't know how big that circle is for you, maybe your circle is you, we kind of have this idea, well, that's not my problem. Hope somebody works that out for them, but I don't care. It's not a big deal to me. Oh, I know that their marriage is falling apart and that I have an example and I could talk to them. But you know what? We're not even friends. They go to another church. And this idea of saying, that's not my problem, becomes a problem. Because again, maybe you're the only one that can really speak into them. And it's easy to say, well, that's not my job, it's not my problem. And here's the deal about that, right? We love to say that, we act that way. And maybe you don't say that out loud, but we think that unless it is our problem, and then we look around at everyone else and go, well, why aren't you helping me? I'm in need here. Please, someone, don't you care? Don't you love Jesus? But when it's not our problem, we say it's not our problem. And here's why not my problem is a problem. And that comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 12. He says, the human body has many parts. This is Paul writing to the church in Corinth. And he's talking about spiritual gifts here. And if you want to read more, you can. But I want to do something interesting with this spiritual gifts thing because I want you to hear something that he says here, and I've highlighted it. The human body has many parts, but the many parts make up one whole body. You know that. Your body has different parts. They all do different things. And so he says, so it is with the body of Christ. Some of us are Jews, some are Gentiles, some are slaves, and some are free. But we have all been baptized into one body by one Spirit, and we all share the same Spirit. What he's saying is, look, God brought us together despite our diversity, despite our unique nature and all the things that we are. We have been brought together as one body. We are one. I think we sang that. That's a really good song. We are one. And then a few verses later in verse 26, he goes on and says, if one part suffers, all the parts suffer with it. And if one part is honored, all the parts are glad. All of you together are Christ's body, and each of you is a part of it. See, what he's saying is that, yes, we are unique and we have individual parts, but we are one. And if one of us is hurting, then all of us are hurting. And if it's your problem, then it's my problem. And if it's my problem, then it's your problem, because we are one. We are a whole body. That's the way it works. Full disclosure. Last week, I did the whole lifeguard dressing up thing. And it's winter, okay, right now. And because of it's winter, I wear socks, sneakers. But last week I had to wear flip-flops for the lifeguard thing. So my toes were on display. And because my toes were on display, I thought, well, I have to make my toes look not so nasty as they always do in the winter. And so I did a little trimming of my toenails, you know, to make sure that they looked, you know, acceptable for visual consumption. And I ended up cutting this pinky toe on this foot. I cut the nail too short. It is the spot this small. I'm telling you, like my pinky toe is like that. So I don't know. Feet are weird, but my it's like this little spot on the end of my nail, and the end of my toe there, and it is just a little spot. Let me tell you how much it hurt me. All week, like I'm wearing different socks. I'm kind of walking weird because I don't want to put any pressure on that tiny little spot. Why? Because my whole body hurts. That is my problem. Because it's part of me. And we need to be careful that we don't sit back and be like, sorry, that's not my problem. Somebody else can deal with that. That's your issue. That's your family. That's your people. That's your prime group. We need to, and again, you can't do everything. You can't solve every problem, and you shouldn't try to. You're not Jesus. But if God is calling you to do something, make sure you're not using the, well, that's not my problem excuse. If he's saying, no, you need to go to that person. You need to talk to them. You need to offer them this. You need to share this with them. Do it. Don't sit back and say, well, that's not my problem, God. Because if one of us hurts, all of us hurt. We all are one. So, the excuses here, pride says, with position, I'm too important. Profession, that's not my job. Possession, that's not my problem. And then finally, place in life. And this is what that one says. Well, when I get older, dot, dot, dot. When I get older, then I'll do that. When I get older, I'll fix that part of my life. And I want to, one, say, okay, if you are an MC3 student, high school age, and I don't think anyone's younger than that in here because they're in ignition, and infants, listen up, I'm talking to you too. But don't let that be your excuse. Because Again, these young women in Nehemiah's time could have been like, no, I'm not helping. And yet they got to be a part of it. And get this, they got to be included in Nehemiah to the point that it was so crazy that they were included in Nehemiah that people thought there must be something wrong with them being included in Nehemiah. So students, don't let anyone, and I'll get to that passage in a second. I'm getting excited about this verse. I was a youth pastor for 10 years and volunteer for 8 other years. But don't let this be your excuse. Now, if you are older than the age of high school, don't let this be your excuse. And I mean that. Like, it's easy, well, you know, when I get to retirement age, then I will. When I have more free time on my hands, once my family has grown up, once the kids are out of the house, once, you know, and we make these excuses. We're like, well, God does want me to. Like, no. If God is calling you to do something, don't let this, well, when I get older, be your excuse. I mean, we are a young church demographically. Most of you are in your 20s and 30s. And it's easy to do that. Like, well, once I get, and I hear this all the time, you know, once I have a steady job, then I will. Once we have kids, then we will. Once, you know, the kids are driving, then this is going to happen. And we say these things and we put off what God is calling us to do by making these excuses of when I get older. And we need to stop doing that, despite our place in life. And I don't care how old you are, don't use this as an excuse. 1 Timothy 4:12, Paul is writing to Timothy, who was a young pastor. He was a young guy leading this church, and he says to Timothy, don't let anyone think any less of you because you are young. Okay? If we ended the verse there, it'd be like, yeah, shut up, old people. What you got? You know, like, no, that's not what he says here. He says, don't let anyone think any less of you because you are young, but be an example. And let me tell you something. I mean, we are here and seeing the things that God is doing because we're saying, you know what? We're not content just to sit back and let things be the way they've always been. And there's nothing wrong necessarily with the way things have always been. But if we want to be an example to others, and what are we an example of? Yeah, young power. We're cool. Coolness. Youthfulness. Hair. I don't know. But he doesn't say just in just that. He says, be an example in believers in what you say, in the way you live, in your love, your faith, and your purity. He says, be Jesus. Be an example of Jesus. And don't sit back and be like, well, when I get older, then I'll do that. Be the example now. Guess what? Older people, and I mean, somebody called out my wife here with her comment about bricking the wall. About her age. I don't know who that person was in the back. But older people, such as myself even, we can learn. We can learn from younger people. Be that example of Jesus. Don't let that be your excuse. Don't let that be the reason you don't get involved in what God is calling you to do into this big project. Paul says, don't let anyone think of any less of you. Don't let them look down on you because you're young. He says, be an example by living like Jesus. Be an example of what you say and the way you live and your love and your faith and your purity. And the question is, if you're not those things, then don't sit back and be like, rise up, young people. Because I don't want to see that as an example. Be the example by the way you live. And show people that, you know what, I'm doing this now. I'm not waiting till later. I'm living for Jesus in this moment because that's what God has called me to do. So, 4 things. Position says I'm too important. Profession says that's not my job. Possession says that's not my problem. And place in life says, well, when I get older. Don't let those be your excuses. God is calling you, and He is calling us in general to reach people. Do it. Don't make these excuses. When you're facing the wall, put aside your pride and share the work. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for the example of Nehemiah and even kind of how cool it is that this chapter is kind of almost boring, and yet it is full of wisdom, full of a beautiful story of how you brought people together from all sorts of backgrounds, from all sorts of situations, and brought them together to achieve the purpose of building this wall. And God, I pray for us. We don't have a wall to build, but I do pray that in the tasks you have called us to do, that we wouldn't make excuses, that we would come together and put aside our pride and share the work and not let these different things about about it being our problem or our age or our it's not our job or even being too high and mighty to be able to serve other people. Help us not to let these become excuses for doing what you have called us to do. Help us to boldly go forward and then watch you be a part of it. And watch, metaphorically speaking, seeing a wall come together in just over 50 days. Because you were in it and we were giving up our pride and getting involved in following you. Thank you so much for loving us, Jesus, and for giving us hope. And I pray that you would help us as we have the task before us of sharing that hope with the world, that we would give everything we've got to it. In Jesus' name, amen.